Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. You know, presidents have a lot of weapons at their fingertips. The United States Navy is one. There's a veto pen, even a nuclear arsenal. But with all of that firepower, sometimes the president just needs to kill with a couple of good jokes. So where did President Obama turn when he needed a laugh? One of his writers was David Litt.
To me, I always loved the jokes that were a little edgy. They weren't inappropriate, but they had some edge to them, and they got at some political truth that you're just not allowed to say normally as a public figure.
David Litt arrived in the White House in 2011 and left in 2016 as a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter. You might remember Luther, President Obama's anger translator, played by Keenan Michael Key of Key and Peele. Luther showed up at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner, and that bit was Litt's creation.
In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? And why am I required to come to it? Jeb Bush, do you really want to do this?
Well, David Litt may be a little young for memoirs, but he has one out today nonetheless. It's called Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. It describes a time when he was fresh out of college and an internship at The Onion, and remembering the first time that a joke that David Litt wrote emanated from presidential lips.
I was an intern at a speechwriting firm, and I had also been an intern for The Onion previously, and in Washington, D.C., that passes for a comedy background.
Right.
That was it. I had comedy experience. So.
Does that exemplify the low bar for comedy in Washington that an intern in an office at a firm somewhere can be writing jokes for the president?
Well, the way I explain in the book is that writing something funny for a politician is like designing something stunning for Marlon Brando past his prime. Like, the caveat is really the whole thing there. So I do think that the bar is lower, but people still want to do a good job. And so I was pitching jokes as an intern and managed to get at least one of them. I think I got one or two that year into a monologue. And, you know, of course, that was the highlight of my life up until that moment.
What was the first joke and what did your parents say?
Well, the first joke was, it was for the Radio and TV Correspondents' Dinner. And it was about Chuck Todd, who's now the host of Meet the Press. And President Obama said,
"At this dinner, Chuck embodies the best of both worlds. He has the rapid fire style of a television correspondent and the facial hair of a radio correspondent."
Which, you know, I admit, and I say this in the book, it was not comedy gold, but I was on YouTube watching it over and over and over again. I was like, those were my words. The president just said them. And I told that to my parents, and I think they thought it was, you know, pretty cool, but also they recognized that, like, as jokes go, this is maybe not the funniest thing they ever heard.
And yet good enough to be uttered by the most powerful person in the world in front of a bunch of reporters in Washington.
Absolutely. And so much of the joke when President Obama was telling a joke is that it's President Obama telling a joke. That's where the humor comes from. It's why when I repeat some of these jokes, or I did them in the audiobook and was like, I don't know that that's going to land, but they landed in the room because it was the president being self-aware, playing with his own persona, and he had that sense of timing that, frankly, I don't.
What makes the perfect presidential joke?
To me, I always loved the jokes that were a little edgy. They weren't inappropriate, but they had some edge to them, and they got at some political truth that you're just not allowed to say normally as a public figure. You know, everyone's got to sort of censor themselves a little bit. And sometimes we got to say some stuff that you wouldn't have gotten to say in a regular speech.
And it's a danger always anytime you're talking about comedy. I got to apologize in advance. Deconstructing jokes and explaining why they're funny is the least funny thing you can do.
Yeah.
And yet you're writing for a person whose language is constantly deconstructed. So there's no way around it.
That's right. To me, a lot of the humor in the book really comes from the times I embarrassed myself in front of the president, not from talking about the jokes, but, you know, the time I got caught in my underwear in the coat closet of Air Force One. Telling those stories got to be fun. But then talking about the comedy was sometimes the more serious parts of what I'm writing about, and talking about the language and the process of what went into his speeches.
So you're an intern at The Onion. You're in Washington, D.C. You get a pretty good, not great joke through the president at the 2009 dinner. 2011, you get hired on at the White House. And then I'm sure your eyes just got wide.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time I would go up to the gate, and I'd show them my badge, and they'd let me in. And I'd be like, this makes no sense. you know, people smarter than me, more capable than me, should be working at the White House. And I talk about in the book that my first week there, I put a full cup of iced coffee through the conveyor belt next to the metal detector. And of course, it emerges and is now an empty cup of iced coffee. And the Secret Service guy looks at me and is like, not a lot of metal in that. Just a thought for next time. And I can see him add me to the do not save list. And the worst part is I don't blame him. I mean, I'm like, how is this what a White House employee does? So one of the things I wanted to do with the book was write about that experience of being only human and sometimes extremely only human, but still working in the White House and trying to do your best.
The first time you interacted directly with the president, writing a speech, writing a joke, you were on his turf in the Oval Office, or he came by your office, which is also his turf.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's all his turf that point. The first time I interacted with the president, we were actually in the diplomatic room of the residence, which is one of the most beautiful rooms in the White House. It has this mural of rural American life. And I was in there, I had done the Thanksgiving video address, and President Obama walked into the room, and he's standing up, so we all stand up, and he sits down, so we all sit down, and he's about to start taping when the videographer, a woman named Hope Hall, stops him and says, actually, Mr. President, hang on, this is David. It's the first video he's ever written for you. And President Obama looks at me and he goes, oh, how's it going, David? And I remember I had exactly one thought in that moment, which was, I did not realize I was going to have to answer questions. And then I literally have no idea what I said. I actually blacked out the first time I met President Obama.
Yeah.
So I assume I said fine or whatever, but I can't tell you how I told the president it was going.
But then he became the guy that you had to write for on a regular basis. And you talk about in this book, when it comes to writing jokes for the president, the need to be poignant, funny, self-deprecating is important. But there's also tons of subtext anytime the president opens his mouth. You talk about one event that really interested me. It was a thing called the Alfalfa Dinner in 2009. Now, the Alfalfa Club is conservative, staid, sort of white coattails organization that has its annual dinner on the birthday of Robert E. Lee. And here's President Barack Obama gets up in front of the captains of industry and the famous politicians in white ties at the Alfalfa Club dinner and says, if Robert E. Lee were with us here tonight, the general would be 202 years old. And very confused, says the first black president.
That's right. And I wrote about jokes like that because it was, to me, a good example of walking that line. He wasn't doing anything outrageously inappropriate. He didn't get booed like Donald Trump did at the Al Smith dinner, another one of these joke dinners earlier this year. But he was able to assert himself and say, hey, there's something not quite right about this, and I'm going to get at it through humor, but I'm going to get at it.
Now, you mentioned Donald Trump. President Obama was famous for making fun of Donald Trump, along with Seth Meyers and comedians.
President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! Exclamation point. At real Donald Trump. Well, at real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
In 2016, he did make that joke.
Yeah, and he had to eat some crow on that one.
I do think that is one joke that was not very predictive in retrospect.
Oh, okay, it wasn't very predictive, but there was perceived to be a certain self-assuredness, a certain arrogance in that joke. If not from the president, the same arrogance that affected a lot of people in media. Reporters, journalists, look, I got the election wrong and so many people did. You and the people that you work with put those words in the mouth of the president. It's embarrassing.
I left the White House a couple months before that, so I can't speak to the details of that process, which is one of the reasons why I don't know exactly how that joke or any other that year came about. I do think that there is a sense that with jokes, you're always trying to get at a truth, and sometimes you miss. But I also think that there was, you know, this was April of 2016. It did seem preposterous, and I do think looking back on it, if there's one thing I learned personally from the 2016 election is just because something is incomprehensibly horrible doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And, you know, that's a lesson we should remember going forward as we think about not just the kind of day-to-day risks that we run, but the, you know, what I guess we'd call the long-tail risks that are high but seem almost impossible. We need to do more to make sure to take that stuff seriously, sure.
Well, we've been talking about the humor of politics, but we also have to talk about the politics of humor because there's no way around it when you're writing for the president, even when you write funny jokes and people laugh. you're still image making for the president. You're still trying to win the cycle. If the president's in a tough spot, you want to write great jokes that are going to change the news in his favor, right? And you talk about writing jokes at a time just after the spectacular failure of healthcare.gov and the need to get the president out there loose and funny and self-deprecating at a politically disastrous time.
Yeah, it was a difficult time, but we felt like we had turned a corner at that point, because despite the launch of the website, which was a total mess, by that point 8 million people had signed up for healthcare. We felt like we were back on track. So it was both a chance to acknowledge our mistakes but also let people know that we've moved past them by being confident, by the president making fun of himself. He was able to basically say, "Okay, I'm taking my lumps, but let's move forward on this thing."
Of course, we rolled out healthcare.gov. That could have gone better.
And I think that is something that humor can do, that if you make fun of yourself, certainly if you're a public figure like a president, it's a way of saying, I own this. It's not a uncontrollable scandal. It's not an existential crisis. It was a mistake. I'm on it. We're moving forward.
So talk about in the process, you know, you're the joke writer. You're not the strategist. But the senior people in the communications office must come to you and say, we got to hit this. We're having a bad time. We really want to turn a corner with this speech. When you're writing for the president, there have to be additional pressures above just be funny.
There always are some additional pressures. People always used to ask me, do you write jokes to try to advance the president's agenda? And I would always say no, by which I always meant yes. And the reason for that was just I felt it ought to be worth the president's time to go tell a bunch of jokes. If he's going to have to do this, and it's clearly not the most important part of his job, let's make it integrate in some way into everything else he's doing. So you bring up healthcare.gov. It wasn't hard to figure out that we would want to make some jokes about healthcare.gov and move past the failures of the website, because that's what we were doing in serious speeches. It's what we were doing in the rest of our communication strategy. So the idea was not so much you get a list of top objectives, but to say the objectives that we have every single day, how do we make humor a part of that? And I think the Obama White House did that more effectively than any White House thus far.
Part of that success is the natural comedic timing that President Obama had, beyond question. I mean, whether you like him politically or not, the guy could tell a joke.
Yeah, and I think that won some voters over who said, I don't necessarily know about his policies, but he seems charming. He seems warm. People were also attracted to his personal qualities, to just, you know, the way that he cared about his family. And so all of these things played a part, not just in terms of the policies he's saying, but who he is and how he projects himself. I'm biased, but I do think that that made a big difference.
Hillary Clinton can't tell a joke.
She could tell a joke better than Trump.
Hillary Clinton cannot tell a joke.
So here's something that is interesting. If you look at her new book, the first thing that people have said when they reviewed it is they say, wow, that's actually really funny. And it is interesting to see her let loose a little bit in her public life. And I do think that was something that was missing from some of her public appearances in the past. People who know her, you know, I'm friends with people who have written her speeches, things like that. They always talk about how warm and funny she is as a person, but it is true that that didn't make it into that public persona. And I think we're seeing what that would have been like with this book, and we're seeing that people actually really respond to it. It's another reminder that if you can get that humor just a little bit, it goes a long way.
Now, you talk a lot about jokes and humor in this book, but you were on the sidelines for President Obama's appearance in Charleston in 2016 in the aftermath of the horrific church shooting, where the president gave a eulogy in front of pastors and a grieving crowd, and then famously broke into his own rendition spontaneously of Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
So you talk about this moment in presidential speech making and presidential connection in a pretty powerful way in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I was watching that moment in my White House office on the live stream, and it was a moment when your job as a White House staffer and just the role we all play as Americans came together, because I had watched President Obama over and over and over again. When he would pause, I would usually know what was coming next. And this time he paused, and I had no idea what was coming. And I wasn't sure if he was about to be so overcome by emotion he couldn't continue speaking. I thought he might start to cry. I thought he might just say, all right, enough, we're done. You know, I've said what I need to say and walk away. And then he started to sing. And what to me was so beautiful about that moment, and why it's the defining moment of his presidency for me personally, I don't know how what historians will decide. He was so vulnerable. He was so human. And the fact that he was a good singer but not a perfect singer, that he didn't get every note exactly right, but he was willing to do it anyway, and that was actually some of the beauty of it. That moment to me encapsulated who he is as a person and who he was as a president, because there's this idea that we are not perfect, our hearts can be broken, but we can still aim for something higher, and we can still believe, and we can bring people together by being that best version of ourselves. And watching not just him sing, but watching the entire crowd realize what was happening and join in this moment together, and out of this terrible tragedy create this poignant, beautiful moment. You know, it's one of those things you look back on and it makes you very proud to be an American.
It was one of the most powerful moments, I think, of the Obama presidency that I saw. Well, David Litt, let's talk about today. You're at Funny or Die in the Washington Bureau.
That's right.
A bureau that I admit I did not know existed. I watch Funny or Die all the time. I didn't know there was a D.C. bureau.
Well, it's two people. We do two different things. One is Funny or Die put together between two ferns with President Obama and then with Hillary Clinton later. And we thought, well, we could do that for other organizations. So we've worked with the ACLU, the League of Conservation Voters. We're doing a lot of stuff on healthcare right now. Healthcare repeal, there's a new effort for it. So we're thinking, how do we bring this into the comedy world? How do we make this funny, but also in a way that has a point of view that says, hey, if you thought this was funny, don't just share it, but go call your senator, go call your congressman. And that's a pretty different approach for comedy than we've seen in the past, but it seems like the one we need right now.
I'm going to ask you about process of Between Two Ferns a little bit. This is a bit that Zach Galifianakis does that's hilarious. It requires a great deal of deadpan and sort of deadpan disgust on the part of the guest. How was the president of the United States prepped for this nonsense, which he pulled off fairly well back when they did this?
He did. What was amazing about President Obama's performance, and I wasn't in the room with him, but I talked to the director afterward, and she told me that, you know, they don't usually have just 30 minutes for someone like this. I mean, he had 30 minutes, two takes. So it was the ability to not just do that, but do it very quickly.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talked to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, you know, three times.
No, actually, I think it's a good idea. If I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
I watched President Obama examine jokes in a way that I think he examined much more weighty issues. He could figure out what the most important element of a joke was, and he could do exactly what was required of him to get that element to work the way it's supposed to.
Talk about what it might take to get President Donald Trump to effectively deliver or be a foil, let's say, for Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis.
I mean, how much time do we have? I would say the number one thing you need for appearance like something Between Two Ferns, you need to have a thick skin, and you need to have a sense of self-awareness. And so it's going to be a very long time before Donald Trump would be a successful guest on Between Two Ferns.
And yet Donald Trump is the president. He will probably at some point appear at a White House Correspondents' Dinner, although he skipped it, his first one, so maybe he won't.
Well, I think he was afraid to show up this time because he did so badly at the Al Smith dinner. He got booed by a crowd that never would boo anybody, that I think he realized if he tries to tell jokes the way he's been doing, it's going to be an embarrassing moment. I mean, he made up some reason, but let's be honest, he knew that he would not be able to deliver the goods.
You got a good joke for President Donald Trump for his style and what might be funny for him to say?
I can't say that I do. I mean, the people ask, what would you do if you were writing jokes for President Trump? And I say, well, I would quit. And I do think that's true. I mean, there is I've written speeches, not for President Obama, but for other people where I didn't agree with every single thing they said or you know, exactly the way they'd phrase it. But there's a line you have to draw, and I think, you know, our current president has crossed that line so many times that jokes are not going to save him.
So what's funny about politics right now to you?
To me, what is funny about politics, but it can also – it's very bittersweet – is just that we've reached this level of absurdity where the day-to-day of politics is what you'd expect out of a writer's room. I mean, you had the press secretary of the White House hide behind a bush to avoid taking questions from reporters, and then a few months later, after being fired, show up at the Emmys to do a guest spot. I mean, this is an arc of a show where you would say, okay, we got to tone that down. It's totally unrealistic. And that's where we're living now. But there are fun things you can do with that. There's ways to put a different angle on something that we haven't seen before. And I think the other thing that's exciting about political comedy right now is the chance to be a real part of our political conversation. So we did, at Funny or Die, a short video that was Schoolhouse Rock, I'm Just a Bill, but it was about the Republican healthcare repeal effort and about the way that the bill was being formed in secret and all the stuff that it would do, all the people it would uninsure. And that video got tons of views. People thought it was funny. It was funny, but it also got people to care about this thing and take action. And that's a role that comedy gets to play right now that it didn't always. And so it's exciting to be part of that.
David Litt's new book is called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. And we asked you, is it important that politicians have a sense of humor? Tell us your favorite joke from political history.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm calling from Newark, New Jersey. And I think the best witticism about Washington, D.C. and politics was from none other than Harry Truman, who said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. I think that's the most appropriate thing ever said about Washington.
My name is Patty Halajan, and I live in Kildare, Illinois. What's my favorite joke from political history? Well, just about anything that Al Franken says. I love that man. I'm reading his book. It's a great book. And anything he's got to say, I love.
I was sitting on the dais, and Secret Serviceman walked up with this note from the Hay Adams. It says, Al, don't be nervous. There's nobody important here. Dick Cavett. So, Dick Cavett's here. So someone, let me get this thing out of here. Anyway, it's a tremendous honor to be short.
Hi, this is Maggie from Miami. I think they should have enough sense of humor to identify a joke. To be comical in the workplace, I don't think is necessary outside of their personal preference. Is it important for comedians to be more political?
This is Marilyn from East Hampton, Massachusetts. I recall reading a comment about listening to Adlai Stevenson give a campaign speech in the, I think it was the 56th election. And after the speech, someone came up to him, shook his hand and said, you'll have every thinking man's vote. And Adlai Stevenson replied, I'll need to do better than that. I have to have a majority.
And we got this from East Boston, Massachusetts. How about Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House, when he said, don't write it if you can talk, don't talk if you can wink, and don't wink if you can nod. And also, East Boston loves this moment, the 1984 campaign, President Ronald Reagan, when his political opponents suggested Reagan was too old to continue as president.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
And Charlotte, North Carolina goes back to 1988 for this Lloyd Benson diss of Dan Quayle.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Your voice all this hour at 877-8MYTAKE.